Hi.
Hi.
So, what's this book about?
You didn't read this one either?
Well, I was gonna, but I accidentally read something else.
What?
Vogue.
I hated the book, all right? I have no idea what it's about, and the writer was clearly on drugs when he wrote it. I mean, it went on and on and on like it was written in a total hurry. If I handed in something like this, there's no way I'd get a good grade on it. I mean, it's boring and it's unorganized. And I only read 30 pages of it anyway.
Well, that was passionate, albeit entirely misinformed.
Who dares follow Miss Kelly's lucid analysis?
It's required reading.
With Tom and Stella.
Episode 106, Sharp Objects by Gillian Flynn.
Ma said she saw a ghost once. I'm not scared of them ghosts. Are you?
Dangerous. The other one's in danger.
It's not safe for you here.
Hello and welcome to Required Reading with Tom and Stella, a podcast that's brought to you by the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network. This podcast is all about books and literature, and each month we will take a thorough look at one piece of literature we have both read to determine whether it is required reading. As always, I'm Tom Panarese, and my co-host, my lovely co-host, who would not be any of the characters in this book, if I'm being completely honest, is Stella. How are you?
I'm doing well. Yeah, I suppose we could almost try to figure out who the best character is. It feels like it might actually be the older brother.
Mm-hmm. Or maybe the newspaper editor. I don't know.
Oh, yeah, and his wife. No, you're right. They probably would be because of everything that he had done for her and does at the end as well. Yeah. Yeah, let me just say I'm not into dentistry in that way.
Yeah, we'll get there, right?
Yeah.
So we're both at the beginning of the school year when we're recording this. How are you been?
Where our energy is at its highest.
I know, gosh. I was so tired.
It's downhill from here.
Yeah. But it's going all right.
Yeah, going okay so far and looking forward to getting things started. And this is when I have the most optimism before, you know, any apathy.
The honeymoon period.
Yes, the honeymoon period for sure. Shaping young minds and thinking, oh, this year will be different.
Yeah.
No, it's going okay. And I'm a DEI coordinator for the upper school this year.
Cool.
So I have a little higher of a workload, heavy responsibilities, but I'm excited about that, especially, looking at the state of what this country is in, trying to do my best to push forth, positive agendas.
Awesome. Yeah. Yeah, I started a week ago and it's been pretty chill so far. So that's been kind of nice. I apologize to the listeners if you hear me sniffling on occasion and also if my voice sounds a little froggy. A combination of having to use the teacher voice for the last week when I really wasn't using it all summer. You know, I always slightly lose my voice in the first couple of weeks of school. And my child went away to college a couple of weeks ago, which was really cool. It went very well in the move-in. They started classes today. And then promptly asked me for money for something. I'm like, dude, you have money in your checking account. Go use it. But I started cleaning the room. And that was a lot of dust. And I have a dust allergy. So between my allergies and my voice, I'm a little bit froggy. But I'll be okay. I can, my velvet tones will put you all to sleep at some point during this podcast.
I'm sure there's some suspicious looking blue milk that we could give you, and not the Star Wars type
I was just
either.
Saying this on Tatooine.
No, not that blue milk.
All right. So yeah, so Sharp Objects is our book. It is by Gillian Flynn. What's your history with this book? Oof.
Yeah, I listen, whenever you're, and I guess she just, Flynn just has three novels, which I should not say just, because that was disrespectful. Flynn has three novels. And I know nothing about this woman, but I can just imagine when writing these that maybe she needs some emotional space in order to write the next one, because all of them have been really traumatizing. You know, started with Gone Girl, seemed to be kind of a craze, I think, when Gone Girl came out. And I remember seeing that film, and I feel like people went into the film maybe not having read the book. And I was like waiting, because there's this one scene that is like so awful, and I'm waiting. And it, I mean, the audience did not disappoint, because I was ready for what was about to happen. And then everyone was like, and then I read this one, I think on recommendation, or I had seen a colleague of mine at my previous school reading it. So I thought I would give it a go. And then shortly thereafter, I had read Dark Places. So I'm all caught up on what she has done. But yeah, so I read Sharp Objects. And then the show with Amy Adams came out. I'm not sure. I mean, you'll tell us how long that space was. But I also watched that. So that's like double the trauma. But I mean, Amy Adams is an amazing actress. So yeah, it's great to see her interpretation as our lead. So this is my second time reading it. I had hoped that you were going to choose one I hadn't read. I guess I thought that she had more.
She has a short story, and that's
about. Yeah. And so I thought, oh, maybe he'll pick one that I don't have to like traumatize myself again. And then you said Sharp Objects, and I'm like, well, back into the battlefield of this one. So it was, I suppose, less traumatizing, if only because I knew the main story beats. But it's still, I mean, it's really heavy and troubling. And the ending is also very heavy and troubling.
Yeah.
But she does craft an amazing story and an amazing mystery. And I think seeds clues well enough that once you go back, you're like, aha. So yeah, second time. Hopefully, you know, maybe the last time. I don't think I need to read it again. But yeah, here we are.
Yeah. Yeah, I my history with Flynn is although funny, I probably read her stuff in Entertainment Weekly, because I used to read Entertainment Weekly when she was a television critic or reporter. But I wouldn't have recognized the name at all back then. But Gone Girl was the first book I ever read by her. I've actually never seen that movie, and I intend to watch it. Maybe I'll reread the book first. I've also not seen the Sharp Objects miniseries with Amy Adams. It's on my kind of to watch list, and it sounds like it's very good.
It is very good,
because it got a lot of praise. So over the summer, I kind of fell down this rabbit hole of like, first, like suburban suspense books, the kind of Lane Moriarty type of things. And I think it was like Sally Hepworth was one of the authors I was reading. She was a Australian author. And then Lisa Jewell was somebody who I just got a book on Libby from. I haven't read it yet. And then, because I'm finishing another book. And then, it's like Geneva Rose, I think is her name.
Yes.
I read Home is Where the Bodies Are Buried, which I really liked. And then a book called of hers, which I really, really liked, called You Shouldn't Have Come Here. And I'm not going to give away anything about that. There's the types of books like you can read in like a day, and they're just, they're fun and really intense in places. And like, you are just turning the page because like, I want to see what's going on. So as I was searching through book list and then Libby to find, you know, more books to read or put on hold, Gone Girl got recommended to me, and I'm like, well, I've read Gone Girl before. So I said, what else does Gillian Flynn have? Because I knew about Sharp Objects. Sharp Objects was on like a 4 to 6 week wait on Libby. So I put that on hold, but Dark Places was available. So I read Dark Places on the plane, mostly on the plane back from Florida on vacation back in July, and really, really enjoyed that. It was fascinating in the way, because it was just like the way she she goes to things where it's like, you know, you really did a lot of diving into like the background of these things, and then the circumstances behind that book at the end of what the twist is. I was like, that was really, really well plotted. And then this became available, and so I was like, well, let's go ahead and read this for the show. So that was my motivation behind choosing it. And so I read the books in a slightly reversed order than you did. I read Dark Places before I read Sharp Objects. So all right, so let's go ahead and get into the bio for the author. A lot of this comes from Wikipedia, of course, as I tend to do. Your favorite place for when you have to do a summary and a bio because you have in 24 hours because you forgot to do your document. All right, so Gillian Flynn, and it is a hard G. I actually did look that up. It is Gillian, not Jillian. Gillian Flynn was born in Kansas City. Both of her parents were educators. Her mother, Judith Ann, was a reading comprehension professor. Her father, Edwin Matthew Flynn, taught film. She's described herself as a painfully shy child, finding refuge in reading and writing. Her interest in storytelling was further cultivated by her father's love of horror films. And now I can totally see it. As a young woman, Flynn worked assorted jobs. And I really included this bit because of what's going to come up, including selling honey baked ham and giving out yogurt samples in the mall dressed as a quote tuxedo clad cone. So I just want that image of this teenage girl dressed as an ice cream, as a frozen yogurt cone that is wearing a tuxedo. She earned her undergrad degree in English and journalism from the University of Kansas. After spending 2 years in California writing at a trade magazine for human resources professionals, Flynn moved to Chicago. She attended Northwestern's Middle School of Journalism. She completed a master's degree in 1997. Initially aspiring to become a crime reporter, she ultimately chose to pursue a career in creative writing. After graduating from Northwestern, she worked in freelance briefly at U.S. News and World Report before joining the staff at Entertainment Weekly in 1998 as a feature writer, and eventually became a television critic. She was there until about 2008. She credits her years in journalism with helping her hone her writing skills. She says that journalism taught her the discipline of writing without waiting for inspiration. She said, "I could have not have written a novel if I hadn't been a journalist first, because it taught me that there's no muse that's going to come down and bestow upon you the mood to write. You just have to do it. I'm definitely not precious." Flynn's portrayal of complex, morally ambiguous, and often unflattering female characters has drawn criticism from some critics who have accused her of misogyny. I did put a question about that into our discussion. However, Flynn identifies as a feminist and has defended her choice to write female characters who defy conventional expectations of women as inherently nurturing or morally virtuous. She states, quote, "The one thing that really frustrates me is this idea that women are innately good, innately nurturing." To her, people will dismiss, quote, "trampy, vampy, bitchy types," but there's still a big pushback against the idea that women can just be pragmatically evil, bad, and selfish. While working at Entertainment Weekly, she wrote Sharp Objects. This was her debut novel. It was shortlisted for the Mystery Writers of America Edgar for Best First Novel and won the Crime Writers Association New Blood and Ian Fleming Steel Dagger. Sharp Objects was later adapted into a 2018 miniseries starring Amy Adams. Flynn's second novel, which was Dark Places, came out in 2009. It follows a woman who begins to question whether her incarcerated brother was truly responsible for the murder of their family during the Satanic Panic era of the 80s when she was a child. And then her third novel was Gone Girl, 2012. So that novel came out 13 years ago. Centers on Nick Dunn, tall, small-town Missouri creative writing professor, his wife Amy Elliott, who mysteriously disappears on their fifth wedding anniversary. Gone Girl topped the New York Times bestseller list for 8 weeks. It sold over 2 million copies by the end of 2012, and it was adapted into a 2014 film that was directed by David Fincher. It starred Ben Affleck and Rosamund Pike. Flynn's short story, The Grown Up, won the Edgar Award for Best Short Story. Originally, it was published under the title What Do You Do in the 2014 anthology, sorry, in the 2014 anthology Rogues, which was edited by George R.R. Martin and Gardner Dozios. It was later released as a standalone publication in 2015. That story follows a sex worker turned fake psychic hired by a woman to cleanse her Victorian home, which is troubled by a deteriorating marriage and a disturbing stepson. And that sounds really intriguing. I'm going to go have to check it out. It does. Doesn't it sound like really intriguing? I'm like, okay, that could be interesting. Sharp Objects attained critical acclaim. Literary critics praised Flynn for her exploration of psychological complexity, dark family dynamics, and her sharp prose. No pun intended. The novel was lauded for its disturbing atmosphere and its handling of deeply flawed yet compelling characters. So, anything else to add before I get into our plot synopsis, which is a little bit lengthy? I did try to trim it down, but.
Thing for me.
All right. This was from, oh gosh, like literarycircles.org or some site like that that had a really thorough summary of it because the one on Wikipedia actually was missing a lot of information. Camille Preaker works as a reporter at the Daily Post, an unremarkable newspaper in Chicago. When Camille's boss, Frank Curry, sends her to her hometown of Wind Gap, Missouri, to investigate the second missing girl there in less than a year, she is reluctant to return. The withdrawn, heavy drinking Camille holds within her a wealth of trauma and pain related to the death of her younger sister Marianne years ago. When Camille arrives, she pays a visit to the closed off Sheriff Chief Vickery, who is reluctant to talk about either case of missing girls. After prodding the man, she learns that the last year, a 9-year-old Ann Nash was found strangled to death in a creek in the woods with all of the teeth pulled from her mouth. Now, 10-year-old Natalie Keene is missing too. Camille pays a visit to her mother's house and asks to stay there for the duration of her assignment. Camille's family is Wind Gap royalty. Her mother, Adora Crellin, is the heiress to a hog farm which produces 2% of the country's pork. The next day, Camille arrives downtown and stumbles upon a horrific scene. Natalie Keene's body has been propped up on the street, and all of her teeth are missing from her mouth. The day after Natalie's funeral, Camille goes downstairs to find her half-sister, Alma, sitting on the porch, playing with a 4-foot dollhouse, an exact replica of Adora's sprawling Victorian manse. Though 13 years old, with the blossoming body of a young woman, Amma is dressed like a young child. Camille realizes that she has seen Amma around town over the last several days with a gaggle of girls, but they're always dressed provocatively and behaving strangely. Amma ex explains that when she's home, she's Adora's doll. When she's with her friends, she's other things. Downtown, Camille manages to talk to Vickery, but the two are quickly interrupted by Richard Willis, a detective from Kansas City who has been sent to investigate the murders. When Camille returns home, she undresses and looks over her own ruined body. She is a cutter who has scarred herself hundreds of times with hundreds of words into every surface of her skin, save for her face and the neck and the center of her back. Camille began cutting when she was 13 and continues to feel her skin scream at her in moments of stress. The next day, Camille runs into Richard again and the two strike up a deal. He asks Camille to help him understand Wind Gap's violent history. In exchange, he offers to help Camille with her reporting. On her way home, Camille encounters Emma and her friends stealing flowers and gifts from where Natalie's body was found. The following day, Camille runs into a group of her mother's friends at a restaurant. The women invite Camille to sit with them, and she overhears their gossip about the person the women may suspect might be the murderer, who is John Keene, Natalie's teenage brother. A drunken Jackie, that's one of her mom's friends, warns Camille that Adora has been acting strangely lately. Camille then heads over to the Nash home to question Anne's parents, Bob and Betsy, about their daughter, whom they describe as headstrong and fierce, before revealing to Camille that Adora was tutoring Natalie and Anne in spelling. On the way home, Camille spots Emma putting around town in a golf cart. She follows her all the way out east to the hog farm, where she watches in horror as Emma sits down in front of a nursing pig and squirms with delight at the as the sow's piglets fight over her bloody nipples. The following day, Camille tries to question Natalie's mother, but is thrown out of the house when Mrs. Keene realizes that Camille is a reporter. John Keene's girlfriend, Meredith Wheeler, who's driving past at that moment, offers to have John talk to Camille. Meredith and John show up at Adora's house to talk with Camille. Over the course of this conversation, it emerges that John doesn't have an alibi for the night Natalie was killed, and Meredith, who's a popular cheerleader obsessed with her own image, is desperate to clear John's name. Camille has heard about both Anne and Natalie's headstrong personalities. John admits that he and his family moved to Wind Gap from Philadelphia after Natalie attacked a classmate with scissors, blinding her in one eye. Camille and Richard spend the following day driving around together, and the two share a kiss. That evening, when Camille returns home, Adora is waiting for her downstairs, seemingly drunk. Adora confesses that she never loved Camille. She wishes it was Camille and not Marion who gotten sick and died. The next morning, Camille interviews Meredith, who reveals that Anne and Natalie were both biters. Natalie bit Meredith twice, and Anne even bit Adora. Camille meets up with Richard and asks whether he believes a man or a woman committed the murders. Richard says he thinks a man is responsible for the crimes. A woman couldn't have committed such abject violence. Camille reveals that she's learned that Anne and Natalie were violent biters, but when she refuses to divulge who they bit or why, Richard accuses her of stringing him along, and he leaves. The next day, she goes over to Richard's apartment to apologize, and the two of them have sex, although Camille insists on keeping her clothes on to hide her scars. Later, Camille goes to a party with Amna and her friends. Amna gives Camille OxyContin and ecstasy. Later that night, she allows Amma to fall asleep in her bed, but Camille has a dream in which Marion appears to her and tells her that it's not safe in Adora's house. In the morning, Camille wakes up feeling awful. Adora comes to the bedroom and feeds her a blue pill. In a haze, Camille heads down the hall to Amma's room. Amma is sitting naked on the floor in front of her dollhouse, and after confirming that Adora gave Camille the blue, warns Camille what's about to come. Camille realizes that Adora poisoned Marion to death and is now doing the same to Amma. Camille rushes to Jackie's. Jackie admits that she always suspected Adora's responsibility for Marion's death and urges Camille to leave town. Now, Camille's still terrified of going back home, so she drives out to a bar on the edge of town. There she finds a very drunk John Keane, who begs her to believe that he is innocent. Camille knows what it is like to lose a sister and promises John she believes him. The two of them head to a motel together where John and Camille have sex, and John glimpses one of Camille's scars and demands to see them all. She allows him to become the first man in 14 years to see her naked body. In the morning, Richard and Vickery knock on the motel door. Adora called the police to report that Camille hadn't come home. Richard is shocked and dismayed to find Camille with John and refuses to accept her apology. Camille visits her old high school friend Katie, who was an aide at Anne and Natalie's school. Katie revealed that Amma was particularly awful to Anne and Natalie. Camille finally goes home and Adora offers her a large glass of bluish milk. Camille decides to take her mother's medicine again to prove to herself that she isn't crazy. But 20 minutes later, she begins vomiting and rushes herself to the nearest hospital, where she demands to see Marion's old files. In them, she finds a note from a nurse who suspected Adora of Munchausen by proxy syndrome. This is a condition in which a caregiver, usually a mother, inflicts illness upon another in order to gain attention and sympathy. If you have ever seen the movie The Sixth Sense, Misha Barton, who was like a child at that point, has a small role as the ghost of a girl who had died. And then Haley Joel Osment's character like shows like what had been like a hidden videotape of her mother poisoning her. And that's what Munchausen by proxy is. It's like you are literally poisoning somebody for this sort of attention or sympathy. And you're always complaining that this person is sick and I don't know why they're sick. But the thing is that due to Adora's status in the town, the nurse couldn't convince anybody to speak up. And so what Camille does, she distraught, she stops and goes to a payphone and makes a call to Curry, her editor, in which she confesses that she believes her mother killed Marion, Anne, and Natalie. After hanging up, Camille tracks Richard down at a local restaurant and accuses him of suspecting Adora all along. Richard says that he has obtained a search warrant and will be coming by tomorrow. Camille returns home and Adora invites Camille up to her bedroom, a room that Camille has long been forbidden from entering. As Camille enters, she marvels at the exquisite ivory floors. Adora invites Camille into bed with her and fixes her a drink, apologizing for not loving her. Camille swallows the drink and tells Adora that she will never forgive her for what she did to Marion. Camille wakes up feeling fevered and weak, covered in her own sweat and urine. Adora helps Camille into the bathtub and feeds her more pills and more blue milk. Camille's thoughts begin to blur and she falls asleep in the tub. She's woken by screams sometimes later, just as Richard bursts in through the door. He tells Camille that everyone needs to get out of the house and offers to take her to the doctor for testing. That evening, police find an exhaustive array of industrial-grade laxatives and emetics, illegal antibiotics, and horse tranquilizers in Adora's room. Every single medication is found in Camille's toxicology test. Police also uncover a diary in which Adora details her treatments of Marion and admits to killing her when she couldn't stop making her ill. The police also find a pair of pliers in Adora's room, trace amounts of blood found on them, which belong to Anne and Natalie. So Adora is arrested for the murders, and Camille takes custody of Emma, bringing her back to Chicago to live with her. Emma proves an exhausting charge. She's nervous, needy, and obsessed with female killers. She rejects therapy and demands that Camille buy her expensive furnishings for this dollhouse. As time goes by, Emma makes a friend at school named Lily. And Lily comes over often. One night, Camille wakes up to find Emma standing over her, feverish and sweating, accusing her of liking Lily better. Emma then asks for Camille to care for her like Adora did. When Camille says they won't do things Adora's way, Emma sobs. A few months later, Lily disappears on the way home from school and is found dead a few blocks from Camille's apartment with 6 teeth missing. Camille finds the teeth in Emma's dollhouse and realizes that Emma was using the teeth pulled from her victims' mouths to recreate the ivory floor of Adora's bedroom. The investigation in Windgap is reopened, and police find that Emma, along with 3 of her friends, killed Anne and Natalie. Adora is tried and convicted for the murder of Marion, while Emma is incarcerated in a juvenile detention facility. Camille visits her once, and during their conversation, Emma admits that when Anne bit Adora on the wrist, Emma became indignant about the ways in which she tacitly agreed to suffer in exchange for Adora's love. Camille relapses, scarring the unblemished circle of flesh on her back, and moves in with Curry and his wife Ellen, who care for her and parent her as her well for the first time in her life. Camille finds herself worrying often about the night she cared for the sickly Emma. She enjoyed taking care of her younger sister and wonders whether or not she has inherited Adora's sickness or whether she is, in spite of all the horrors that she has suffered, a kind person after all. So that's a pretty thorough synopsis of the book. Stella, what did you think? Did you like it?
That this is one of those questions, I don't know how to answer it, because I didn't really like the stuff that was going on in there. Was I engaged? Yes, for sure. And it's really interesting. So it's just one of those, like, maybe I liked it, maybe I didn't like it, but it was obviously good. So that's how I'll answer that question.
Yeah, I liked it for the... It was intriguing. The characters are fascinating, but it's not like I didn't like it in any sort of slasher movie way of like, I really liked how people were getting killed, that type of stuff. But what was going on was horrific enough. And I thought Flynn, like the tone and the mood of the piece matched the extremity of the killings. So like, you know, you have this really, really awful crime. And everything around this book is very, very dark. And I think she did a good job of matching that. So yeah, but no, I really did enjoy this. I mean, this just like when it got going, I don't think I really was putting it down very much. So, it's definitely darker than some of the other books I mentioned earlier, you know, the sort of thriller suspense novels I've been reading. Flynn seems to be able to go places that other writers aren't completely going, you know?
Yeah.
So, and that's kind of interesting. So, yeah, so let's get into this. I'm going to bounce around the different questions. So let's start with Camille. She is she's obviously a flawed character, a flawed, protagonist, like just as a character, like what did you think of her? Because she is our view into all of this. And she is incredibly complex. Like, were you on her side rooting for her? Or were like, what did you think of her as a person or character?
Was I on her side? I think mostly I am on her side. I think given her propensity for cutting, her history of cutting, I will tend to be supportive of those people because it's clear, you know, that they are going through something. And I think that they deserve our support and our ears. Mm-hmm. And the backstory of everything regarding her mother and her sister, I think leads her to be a pretty sympathetic character. And we've discussed how narrators we have to see, can we trust them or not? We always have to think about that. But because of what, well, this is this third person? Wait, I can't even remember. It's been a little while.
I checked my copy of the book back in.
She plucked a foot. Okay, it's third person. Mm-hmm.
But it's like from her perspective.
It mostly is from her perspective, yes. But because it's third person and, you know, what her mother is saying, you know, we're actually seeing that happen. It's more mm-hmm. believable. There are certain things that I, you know, disagree that she is doing. The biggest one for me, I think, is getting with John sexually. Mm-hmm. He was of age. That was made very clear. However, it was just rather troubling. So yeah, for the most part, I am on her side. I think it's definitely someone that, you know, needs our support, but also should be held accountable, you know, for some of her actions as well.
Yeah, I agree with everything you said, and I would add that she gets very frustrating sometimes, and like the sex with John is like one of those moments, because she was having not like a really sweet romance with Richard, but it did seem like one of the few genuine things she had going for her, even though like clearly they were also kind of, you know, it kind of comes out later as it evolves, you like you realize, oh, they're both kind of also using each other to get to the story, you know, for, because he's investigating her family and she's investigating the crimes and stuff, and he's, you know, etc. But yeah, the moment with John, I was just like, and the, you know, and frustrated with like things like the substance abuse and things that are going on in a way that's not like coming down on anybody who does that, but like, you know, because like you want to see her, I wanted to see her get better, and yeah, it's just she kept like sabotaging herself. And I would imagine a lot of that has to do with like being home around her mother, who is cruel.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Adora is, do you see any redeeming qualities in this woman? Is there any goodness? Or is she human? Yeah. Is she human or more kind, or is like everything clouded by like, there's a, like clouded by like her being, you know, actually kind of evil.
I think the only redeeming factor is, because I think with Munchausen by proxy, if you really dig, it is that there's like this caring instinct for the person who is doing it. I think cares, but it is just become so perverted and toxic that this is what it has turned into. Mm-hmm. And so I think like when you come down to it, she just wants to be needed, which is the opposite of Ama, who, you know, really wants to be cared for.
Yeah.
And so I think if you were to pull back, you could be like, well, that is, I think, what Adora, or who Adora is. You can also have some empathy for her in regards to her own upbringing, which it's clouded because Adora says some wackadoodle stuff. Like, I remember she was telling, well, we only find out from Alan, you know, the things that she was, that she accused Camille of doing, and Camille's yeah. like, I was not doing that at all, or I never said any of that stuff. So you can only trust so much. But I think even Alan and other people also knew, like the friends or the circle, they kind of knew how Adora's mother was. So it's like this generational thing that was just kind of passed down, it seemed like, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. So I can extend, I think, empathy and maybe try find a reason for why she is committing these atrocities. But yeah, it's, once you get down to it, it's still pretty bad.
Yeah. And it kind of starts to helps you explain, like, why was she tutoring these two young girls? And I don't think that she would have ever actually started to poison them in the way that she did her family. I maybe she was too far gone to actually like discern that like it would have been easier to point, her daughter is one thing in the house, but somebody else's daughter, like, I don't know if she would do that. But that idea that she had to be needed, or somebody needed to need her, and so therefore she's doing this, like helping the kids and everything, because otherwise her entire status is just as the richest woman in town, and there's an emptiness to that, right? What's the poem? Richard Cory, which is a poem by Edwin Arlington Robinson. And basically the premise of that particular poem is that here's the richest guy in town, and we all work at this factory, and we all want to be him, and at the end it takes a twist, and it's like in that night Richard Cory went and put a bullet in his head, and that's like the line. And it's like, the idea that the person on the outside who's up on the hill looks like they have it all, but there's something very dark and deep inside of them. And so that's something that I think Flynn's pulling at with a character like Adora, but it becomes very like it harms others as opposed to herself. And so that was a really interesting way of putting it. And she's in the town. So like Camille has not been in Wingate for like, I think it was like 14, 15 years or something, and really was estranged from her mother, and she had to go back because, Curry was like, you have a connection to this town, it's going to be easier. And there she reflects at one point, she says Curry was wrong. And oh, by the way, I got some of these questions that I'm asking Stella from like a bookclubs.org or bookclubs.com website, where they had a bunch of book club and study questions for this book. So I've paraphrased and cannibalized a few of them just to give credit where credit is due, right? So soon after arriving in Wingate, Camille reflects, quote, Curry was wrong. Being an insider was more distracting than useful. So, like, he thought that Camille had advantages in insider status, but why was he ultimately wrong about that? Like, what is she pointing out there?
The social dynamics coming back to your hometown, I think, are always interesting. And this is sometimes it can be fun catching up with people. And I think in this case, it was hard for her. So the assumption is being an insider, you're going to be able to get information because you know the people that you need to talk to, or you'll find out the people you need to talk to. You probably already have a relationship or a tangential relationship with those people, and then you can make your way inside, which is true because some of her mother's friends, she was able to go over there and talk to them, some high school people, etc. However, because they know her, they get distracted in their speech talking about her, and their time in the pay because, Camille had done some things that, people are aware of. So they're distracted by that. And they're also distracted by her relationship with Amma, who really, I think, is present, people know her as like terrible, a terrible child. And so, I think they wonder why is Camille asking all these questions when you know about this stuff when you know about your sister, right? Like why aren't you talking about that? So I would say that that's maybe part of it as well. 'Cause yeah, she has no anonymity. Everyone knows who she is. Also, she goes over to, was it Natalie's house? And then her mom finishes the interview because, or she ends it because she found out where she was and basically told her to leave. So you got that issue as well.
I agree with you, and so you're adding that strained dynamic with the people that you grew up around to this, I'm a reporter reporting on this horrific tragedy that has happened. So I get Curry's logic. Because it does seem like, oh yeah, you're from there. You know your way around. You can probably get to places that most outsider people wouldn't go. But he does not realize that there's so much baggage with her that it gets in the way. Do you think Flynn does a good job of showing Wingate as like a fully formed kind of community? And not going too far into kind of the cliche of this is a small hick town that like there's like one rich person, all the way up in the hill and things like that, and there's all these dark secrets. Because I know she's kind of playing with that, but do you think that she does enough to make the town seem like a real place, that she avoids the kind of like terrible cliches that go along with it.
Yeah, I feel like even though I can tell who is in the upper crust, I can't tell anyone else's socioeconomic status.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Maybe in the bar you can tell that people are super blue collar, as if you can add super as a modifier to blue collar. But but yeah, I couldn't really tell. So I think she does a good job there, because I actually forgot that it's Missouri, isn't it? Because at one point, like halfway through the novel, I forgot where we were and was thinking it was Ohio. So I can't really tell, which I think is good, because I think the issues are not about the economy or class. I think it's something else is happening. Something else is afoot. Yes, I just want to be sure that I'm answering all of your questions.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And it comes off as like, I think Flynn's probably writing from some sort of geographic familiarity, because she's from Kansas City, right? Or just outside of Kansas City. So she knows, you know, she might know rural Missouri to a certain extent. But I think there's a universality of a town like that in a number of parts of the country. So like you mentioned Ohio, it could be West Virginia, it could be in the upper Midwest. Like there's plenty of towns like Wind Gap, and I think and we've seen them portrayed in movies before anyway. I said, like I said, there's a cliche about it, but I think what's cool is that you do feel like these people in the community are real people, and that the way she's able to show how they're all connected, either through family or friends or high school, like her best friend Katie was an aide at the school and blah, blah, blah. That's very realistic. You know, you spent a lot of time in Charlottesville, you know, a good port. You lived here for a good number of years. I've been here for 20 years and also worked in kind of surrounding counties. And there are a lot of people like that who's like, I know this person, or I went here and now I work here. And that interconnectedness, that web of people is, can be a virtue of a place, but can also like really hinder the people who live there. And it's a realistic portrayal of a town like that, I think. Even the whole fact with the hog farm and the mansion and everything, there's always, you know, that's pretty common too. We are going to get to Emma, but we'll go a little bit more down the road.
You sure we can't skip
Emma? Yeah, no,
and just talk about the whole novel without her.
So with Camille, we mentioned the cutting, right?
Mm-hmm.
Why the worst? Because like most of the time I associate with cutting, it's just like a straight line or something across an arm or a leg, like, you know, you would see in like, you know, very special episodes of TV shows and things. Or I didn't expect to hear her about words being carved in. And there's something interesting is that, like you said, the synopsis said it kind of flares up, or it screams at her, skin screams at her when she gets stressed. And the way that Flynn shows it is that she'll highlight whatever word she's feeling that's on her skin, right? Like she'll say this, it's almost like these words pop up and they're like where they are on her body. So what did you think of the whole carving words into herself thing? Like why do that? And did you like it? What did you think of it?
Did I like it, Tom?
Why do you think she does it, first of
it's an interesting take on cutting. I have no experience with cutting.
Neither do I.
My only experience, which is both, I guess, positive as well as negative, I'm sure that I have students that cut that I'm unaware of.
Yeah, same.
I will say that one time I went to a cat cafe and I remember sitting down and looking over, there's another person also sitting down, and I saw these marks on her leg and I thought, well, she's a survivor. She's made it. Mm-hmm. But anyways, so yes, that's all I know of cutting is from media, that it's usually just like this line that they typically do. So this felt to me atypical. But I thought that it was interesting and something that was not a stretch and something that I could see actually happening because I think, I certainly have words that are pretty hateful that blare in my head about myself, that I kind of think about myself in these terrible terms. And really, that's like a few steps removed, right? I'm not the action, that action itself is already pretty damaging. But then like physically manifesting it. So I can see how that could happen. I thought that it was powerful how those words pop up in moments. There were a couple times I couldn't necessarily see the connection of the words, but I appreciated the ones when she used them, and yes, location and where it was. And that's another thing is just the fact that Camille remembers every word and every location. And I think there's also overlap. So I can almost imagine her body being a palimpsest as well, that there are layers of words. And it was interesting. There's one section I do not recall what word it was, unfortunately. It was near the end of the novel where she said, "That's a word that's not on my body." And then, of course, you have a couple spaces which are really for, I think, physical reasons because that back circle would be. It would potentially be hard to do. Well, I don't know. I'm reaching back now. But you do kind of wonder why that circle was left alone and what a dark moment when her mother was bathing her and said something along the lines of like, "You've left this space for me, like I'm gonna carve it up." And I'm like, oh my gosh, this is really bad. And she ends up attempting to carve something at the very end of it. So, your overall question was the cutting. Yeah. Oh, why do I think? Yeah, I think I would just go back to me personally and kind of these words that screams out loud and rather than keeping it inside, it has just outwardly manifested itself.
Yeah, no, I agree. I thought it was I thought it was an interesting way to portray this. Now I'm kind of curious, like I said, I intend to watch the Amy Adams series because I've heard so many good things about it, but I was gonna watch it, but I was like, no, let me do the discussion here first because I don't like watching adaptations of things before I discuss them if I haven't seen them already, because I just want to make sure I have like kind of the book in mind and not the movie. But I'm kind of curious of like how this actually shows up, like how big the words are, if it's hundreds of words, you know? Stupidly, I'm thinking there's a Batman villain like called Victor Saz or something like that,
Oh,
and
yep.
his whole thing is that he carves a hash mark into his skin for everybody he's killed, so his body is covered in like 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 across like all over the place and stuff like that. So it's kind of thinking of that like they must be small words, and there's so many of them. Like, so you're picturing her wearing like just kind of long sleeve shirts and pants and dresses and things because she's, you know, keeping what little of herself is not damaged, visible. And I thought that she, as an author, Flynn pulled this off without making it a silly gimmick, right? Because it could be a gimmick, and it could be kind of like cringy if you're not taking it seriously, or you're shoehorning it into every single moment, just to remind everybody. And I think, like you said, there were a couple of times where, yeah, it doesn't necessarily land the way it should, but overall, it does. And I like that you pointed out that last part, that one part where it's like, this isn't a word on me, but it's like kind of hinting at, you know, maybe she would go back to doing it or something like that. And, I did like when they kind of flared up and the words were there. I thought that was a good way of doing it. And again, she didn't overdo it either. And I thought that was really cool. So we talked a little bit of Munchausen by proxy, but we can talk about like her. She was really like devastated by her sister's death, because I think she essentially like talks about how she watched it happen. Like she watched her sister deteriorate. And did you have a feeling before it started to come out that this is what was going on? the whole Munchausen by proxy thing, like as you were reading about Camille's deterioration, did it ever pop into your mind that Adora was poisoning her?
I think it maybe not immediately, but before I think it started clicking for Camille, I think yes, that it started just because she would get better and then she would get worse. The cyclical nature of it seemed rather suspicious, as well as how you know her mother treating her and you know her sister differently and things like that. So I would say that those would be kind of the clues that I was looking for initially.
Yeah, the same. There was a point, because I've read a little bit about it or heard a little bit about it, and there was a point, I can't tell you the exact point, but it was before Camille realized what had happened, that I was like, this does sound like Munchausen by proxy. And that made it fascinating for me. I was like, ooh, this is interesting. But yeah, and I, you know, there's a question here, and I'll ask, do you think that she did it on purpose? Like Camille seems like she thinks that that Adora actually did kill Mary, and like that was what she intended to do, especially as she finds kind of the evidence she finds. Do you think Adora intended to kill her or all along, or was it just kind of she did at the end, or like, you know, where do you think the "my daughter is going to die" kind of clicked in Adora's head, and was she doing it on purpose at any point?
I think that's how kind of far gone she was. Going back to my previous point, I just really think that she loves being a caregiver, and this was the best way to feel needed. Makes her feel whole, and so I think she loved doing this because then she, you know, she had a sick child and she was able to take care of her. But I think she's so far gone that she doesn't understand the limitations and that you can't keep doing this, because I think her mourning is real. Even though it's like she is overly dramatic and she does get upset when Marion is brought up and things like that. I think in regards to that comment about "if only you had died instead of Marion," whenever she said that, I think that was truly because, yeah, she loved Marion so much, and she always saw Camille as an issue, and Camille was only an issue because she was so self-sufficient, and she wasn't ever doll like, which you know, not to be sick, because that's obviously one of the themes there of the killings, the current killings, and was always angry and kind of wouldn't accept that help. So I think even though she might have been experimented on, but it didn't ever work. But then finally Adora gets this brilliant moment where Camille is, you know, unwell, and both of her own, like, choosing what she was sick before that because of the partying. And then also now, you know, so she has this person who is more, I don't even know what the temperate, I suppose. And so that makes Adora really happy. So I just don't think that, even though that drug concoction is kind of nuts of, I don't know how long that, Camille was going to last. The Camille issue, whether that's intentional or not, that's harder to answer. But I do think that it was not intentional for Marianne.
Yeah. Why did Camille? Because, like, I get it when she's essentially hung over from the alcohol and the X, right? And the OxyContin, because, like, she doesn't have a really clear head when it comes to her own sense of, like, Camille doesn't have a lot of agency in that moment. So she's susceptible to Adora slipping her this blue pill, right? But later on, she does kind of let herself get, she takes the milk and whatever. Why does she decide to let Adora do these things when she's pretty sure this is what killed her sister?
You mean like give her actually receive the drugs.
Yeah, like why does Camille toward the end of the book let Adora essentially poison her? Is she trying to get like is this her way of getting proof of what was going on, or is it just something completely different?
I don't think so because she well, I guess she could in a spiteful way because I remember she and Richard got into the detective got into a row about that, that she was sick. And then he said, why didn't you say we could have tested you? And she's like, because that's all I am. So maybe in his spite. But honestly, Camille is out of sorts by the end of the novel. So I just think that she may have been aware of what's going on. But I think she is just so out of it, like emotionally separate from her body, that she is kind of going along with anything.
Yeah. So it's because it's. If you think about it, she's been back for a while now to a place that she left and never wanted to come back to a family member who she was estranged from, who caused her a lot of harm. So there's a, I know it's an overused term these days, but there's a trauma response going on in a lot of this. And I can imagine that at that long a time. Yeah, you're right. She's kind of breaking down anyway. Mm-hmm. So she's more susceptible to it and more passive, right? So, yeah. But so that's where like Adora gets that upper hand. And I think as the reader, it is a little suspenseful because you're like, is she going to be okay? Because you're right. Like, how can she handle this? Because I would imagine that she, when she was giving it to Marion, she was doing it in low enough, like it's almost like she probably knew the doses, right? She knew the limits of what she could give the girl and whatnot. And maybe it was through trial and error. So I'd imagine she's doing the same, that like she is not trying to kill her daughter, but she's giving her enough to make her sick so she'll have to care for her and stuff like that. Because I think, would you agree with me that somebody who has this Munchausen by proxy condition with a kid they have, they're not trying to kill the kid. Like, that's not their intention.
No.
Yeah.
No, just keep them sick enough that they are. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but then you let them heal a little bit and then you kind of go back. Yeah. Because then there's a void there. Because if you want to be needed and you want to help someone, it's not going to happen if you don't have that person to help. So.
Yeah. And one more question about Camille, and I want to move on to our villain. And this is more light. We've touched on it already, and it's the romance aspect because, you know, here you go, Stella, here's the shipper. So we have Richard and Camille, and then of course we have the moment with this, and it's kind of a romance, and then we have the sex with John. Do you think she was trying to sabotage her relationship with Richard either intentionally or just like subconsciously? And would they have made a good couple if they kept going?
I didn't really like the Richard. I did not ship her with Richard. Mm-hmm. It just felt skeevy. I don't know. Like I just didn't care for it. I think it was definitely unethical in terms of like a quid pro quo situation.
Yeah.
It seemed like sex for information on both sides, even though I do believe him that he liked her. But there's also something. So I think the main answer is no, I don't think that would have been a good one. Are you going to ask about John? Do you want me to talk about the John situation?
I will. I do agree with you. It's the unethicalness of their romance on both sides because they're using each other and taking advantage of each other. There are moments where I think it is kind of a little cute. Like they both almost have like a cynical side to them that matches up very well. So there's a rapport between the two characters, but I don't think they're a good match for one another. I don't think that either of them could care for the other, like care nurturing, not like care in terms of feelings. And I don't think this is what either of them absolutely need. Now, yeah. So what do you think about John, and why does she take her clothes off for him?
Right. Yeah.
But she doesn't take her clothes off for Richard or any other man she's been with in the last 14 or 15 years.
Right. Yeah. She definitely has, I think, a skewed version of sex and love. And yeah, I mean, it started way back when. We get a lot of snapshots of moments when she was sexually engaged.
Yeah.
I feel like the first time she masturbated, she had seen something kind of violent beforehand. Though I cannot recall. So like just those connections, the gangbang and how that was presented, which I imagine you're going to talk about with the misogyny question. Yeah, so the John, I felt like it's hard for me to, 18 is just too close. It would have been lovely because I feel like it's a very beautiful scene, but the fact that he's 18, I just can't get over that. Yeah, I think they bond so well because of the tragedies. At the center of it, they have both lost a sister. And this is brought up, of course. And I think that they seem to each other the only person who can truly understand maybe that pain. I think within John, there's even deeper pain of things that he's going through, being with someone that he doesn't necessarily want to be. It's hard to be in a house, so he had to move with his girlfriend that he is kind of being used by as well. Only being seen as kind of a hot commodity to other people, you know, that's hard sometimes. And yeah, I feel like she was vulnerable with him in this case. I think also maybe being younger, and so maybe there'd be less judgment, and she felt like there'd be less judgment compared to Richard, who I think was very strong. He had a strong outburst when he found out that she was a cutter. And John was more intrigued and interested in everything. So those would kind of my analysis of what's going on there.
Yeah, they understand each other. And I say this through the loss of a sibling. And I think it allows her a very rare moment of vulnerability on a level that she's not used to having. And I found, as much as I was frustrated with her through the novel with the men she was with, I thought that moment was almost sweet in a way, like that she was like metaphorically and physically like letting her guard down. And you could tell she hadn't done that with anybody. The person I think she needed to do it for, and she does without having it become sexual, is her boss, Curry. Okay.
Yeah.
Because, you know, him and her wife are the ones who essentially do save her at the end, or putting her back on the right path. And she wouldn't have been able to do that had she not allowed her vulnerability to be shown toward him when she was, you know, just upset and destroyed over what had been happening. And stuff like that. So it's almost like she had to come to that realization, but she had to do it through somebody who was not going to be a sexual partner.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Emma or Amma. I kept wanting to say Anna, and I like the unique names and everything, but man, Gillian, could you have just called her Anna? Because I kept writing the name wrong. Instead of going like, what you think about her, because like we can have different opinions on her. Let's go with, she's kind of this split personality in a sense. In private, like I said, she's Adora's doll, and she dresses up like an 8 or 9 year old in like dresses. I think she has like pigtails or something at one point, and she plays with this dollhouse that's just a true representation of it's a true scale model of the actual house. So she's getting expensive things to put it in and decorate it as she is. And we know how she gets the recreation of the ivory floor. But on the outside, she's like this eighth grade mean girl, right? Who, by the way, it's like, so on one side, she's this like kind of sheltered, innocent, like immature, stunted growth girl for her mother, like a little girl for her mother. But on the outside, she's like hypersexualized, wearing skimpy clothing, really trying to act like somebody about like 3 or 4 years older than she is. And she's really, really forward and really nasty to a lot of people. In fact, I think she teases John about Natalie, and she teases John about Meredith like all the time, like, to the point where, and she like flirts with him to the point where she makes him like completely uncomfortable all the time. And she does that because she just gets off on it. So like, what do you think of that aspect of her character, that she's like almost like two people in one? And what do you think she's what do you think her goal was there?
Yeah, and even potentially a third because of how she acts with Camille when it's just them, and even Camille is like, why do you act like this different way? And I can't remember her exact reason, but basically saying like, I can't act this nice when I'm with the other people. I suppose it's, again, I do think that she is she likes to be cared for, so she, I guess that's, is that a codependent relationship then between her and her mother?
I think so.
So they unfortunately they suit each other in what their needs are, but I think with everybody, but with everybody else, she takes back that power, I think. So she's super vulnerable with her mother. Can kind of be average every day with her sister, but with everyone else, I think she just shows it's all of her frustrations, I think, that are this Alma on the street and acting however she wants to act. Which I don't know, like, where it comes from. It's just kind of not like, where does something like that begin? Is something I cannot answer. Because some of it, being a mean girl could come from being spoiled, like I could see that, but the intensity of her meanness is just like beyond the pale. Yeah, and going after, yeah, going after John and how she does that, and with a lot of sexual innuendo as well, and oh, the whole thing is just crazy. And then when you get into the, are you getting going to ask a question about the murders? Okay. Just like the violence of it, is just crazy. So I think it's just relaxing so much control with her mother that she finds an outlet for how she can take that back.
That's a really good point. And she can control others too, because it's not just her that commits it, like it's her and like two or three of her friends, to the point where one of them, she had made a comment toward the end of the book where she says that like one of them was clearly starting to crack, and they might, she was thinking about actually getting rid of her, like, you know, to cover their tracks and everything. And that's kind of sick, you know. It's so there's almost this complete opposite person. And then she's a third way with Camille. I want to say that all three of these are aspects of her personality, like her true personality is a combination of all of them. I think Camille wants to believe that this Amma that she saw in these private moments, you know, where she's with her, is the real Emma. And I think Camille believes that because she wants to save this girl, and believing that she's actually this total horrific mean girl is not gonna help her want to save her. I mean, do you agree with me there that like Emma is, that's not really her real personality, just Camille is starting to convince herself that that's what she's actually like, and she's putting on an act in both ways.
You mean when she's nice to
When she's
Camille?
nice to Camille, like where they're kind of like when they're private and everything, it's like Amma seems to act vulnerable and nice, and it's like I can't tell. I want to say that that's her trying to get to Camille, and she's not actually like that, but Camille can be convinced that that's her real personality, and she's playing a role in each other in the other ways.
I don't know. I feel like that is part of her true personality. The only reason why I disagree with you is that because she is nasty to Camille as mm-hmm. well.
Okay.
And so I feel like, no, I mean, you hold on to, don't let me convince you otherwise, but just that's just my thinking is I think she has all these different, because you and I act differently depending on the circle of friends that we're with or family and everything. Yeah. And I think that that is what is happening here, but just to an extreme degree.
Yeah, that's an important point, because I was saying that's not completely her real personality when she's alone like that. It's like it's a mixture of all of the different aspects of her, who she is. But you're right, it is such an extreme and it's such a stark contrast, you know? Because I'm sure if you saw me with my family or with the kids I teach, and then me and you, there's enough of who there's a similarity among all three of them, right? There's certain aspects of my personality. I don't want to assume that you're the same way, that like I could see like that person that I knew in there, even though the way you interact with these other people is a little bit different. With Omni, it's so different. It's like every bit of the personality is like completely different. So there's not a lot of overlap. And it's almost like these things have to mix together to form this person. So I thought that was really fascinating. So what I found interesting too is that like Ami is Adora's latest victim, right? So she's not as far along as Marion was, because she's, you know, obviously ambulatory, but she's also like, you know, she's being poisoned. And Ami's like pretty well aware of what Adora is doing. Did you catch that?
Yes, because she said that sometimes she does not take the pill.
Mm-hmm.
And she just pretends. And she was also aware of, I guess, the times that she was. The weird, like, why is Adora bringing her friends to see her daughter comatose? And the friends aren't doing anything. That blows my mind.
Yeah.
When Ama told Camille about that. But anyways, yeah. So I was aware that she knows what's going on.
Yeah. What I found interesting is that the way these two characters, Camille and Ama, have developed as a result or by their own nature with the help of their mother, is that they both harm. But with Camille, she's harming herself. And Ama is basically a serial killer in the making, you know, like the methodology she uses. It's very serial killer. You know, so she's harming others. And so it's almost like the complete opposite of the way they kind of diverge in terms of the reaction or the response to this. What's it telling us about these characters? And does it kind of tell us that Camille is actually a good person? As she's wondering at the end, she's like, maybe I inherited this sickness, but like, does it suggest like, actually, no, because you're keeping the pain to yourself, you're actually better than you think you are? So it's kind of a double question. So,
yeah, that's interesting how you're comparing these two in that way. Manifesting the harm on oneself versus manifesting
the harm on others. Yeah.
Oh. Yeah, I would say that if we were to, it's hard for me to call anyone a good person.
Mm-hmm.
that she does leans towards good, and that's probably, yeah, I think that would be an indication that if she does have these violent thoughts, it's going to be towards herself rather than other people.
Mm-hmm.
Though those violent thoughts were always about herself, and I feel like Ama has a more or less positive or neutral opinion of herself. I'm trying to think of a time when Ama said anything about her not liking herself, or no. I mean, she definitely is, she's got some behaviors that she definitely needs to be like praised and things like that. Thus,
yeah.
You know, she wants to be cared for. But I don't know that she ever, for instance, if finding out that, oh, she was loved less than Camille, does that, does she then go and think, know, I hate myself, dot, dot, dot. I'm not sure. So I think it's not a perfect like reverse inverse relationship, but it's pretty darn close in my opinion. And then that ending line, the ending line is really what I think pushes me at the very beginning. You know, you're talking about sympathy for her and whether we feel like, you know, there's any redemption in there. And I think the fact that she is asking that question is as powerful as it can get, right? Because the people who aren't asking that question, those are the ones that we have issues with.
Yeah.
But because there's any sort of like, oh no, you know, what have I done there? Have I done right by her, or have I not? Or am I becoming my mother? Am I not? I think that proves that she is, she does not have Adora's sickness, and that she's more or less, a goodish person.
Yeah, the self-destruction, the self-destruction tendencies are a way to cope, because you're right, her mother did not like her, like outright hated her, and then later on says, I wish it was you. Whereas with Amma, it's like she has another Marion, so who she adores, like she clearly adores Amma, or at least more than she likes Camille. So maybe that I think that might contribute to the way the two of them act. But yeah, you're right. The fact that she's asking that question points to the fact of like an inherent goodness and a possible redemption in her. Like she's caring because she's a caring person. She might not know how to do that very well yet, right? Because she's so messed up in her own way, right? Like she's drinks like a fish, and she's, you know, and she's had, you know, her self-mutilation, and then the relationships she's had and everything. So she has it in her to be this caring person that she wants to be, but it's almost like it's going to take time, because there are things about herself that she has to figure out. Yeah, so let's talk about the murders themselves, which, again, the teeth pulled, and then you see the fact that, like, Camille realizes that it was the floor in the dollhouse, which is creepy, so creepy. I was like, ugh. Was there any clue that Amma was behind this with the two girls' murders? I know she was acting weird at various points.
Yeah.
But did it point you in the direction as she was, or were you on the hook thinking, yeah, Adora did this?
Very subtle clues, I think. She doesn't show anything. I think this is the difference in the TV show, is that she tries to prevent Camille from looking in the dollhouse, and there was none of that. So you can't really tell what's going on there. There was, when I went back to the second killing, when that body was found, because I think it was right after she talked with Richard, because Richard had asked, were her eyes open or closed? Because I think the witnesses said closed, and she's like, no, they were open. And so I went back to that particular scene, and it's described, Natalie is described as doll-like, or being sat, you know, in that alley, as if she were a doll. So it's subtle clues like that, but as you are reading, like, that means nothing to you necessarily.
No,
it's only retrospectively,
yes.
There we go, that you kind of start to connect those things. Yes, them giggling, also her friend, with quotation marks, which I can't remember, because there were two of them. Two of them had the same name, and then the other one,
it was like Heather or Jennifer or something. I can't remember what it was.
Yeah, the one that did, yeah, was clearly not having a good time and was sickly, and then would be, yeah. So the details when Camille was looking at that girl, when asking different questions, I think that was also leading me to be suspicious.
Yeah, there was a point as we were going on where I was like, there is something up with Amma beyond the weird behavior around Adora, but I wasn't putting it together until the very end, where it's like I so it really did it didn't shock me. Like, it shocked me the way she was what she was doing with the teeth.
Yeah.
It didn't surprise me. Because when we got to that reveal, I was like, oh, this makes total sense. Like, it's like you, I started putting the pieces together in my head. I was like, oh man, that was there all along, because she really did lead us down the path that Adora was doing this. And Amma was framing Adora for it, right? She put the pliers in the bedroom and those sorts of things. And the lady in white thing, like this little kid witness to, I think it was Natalie's disappearance, or maybe it was Anne's, one of the girls' disappearance, was that there was this lady all dressed in white. And she wanted her to come play, and she went into the woods with her. And really, the way it's described makes you think it's probably Adora, and that maybe Adora, like, well, is she not all there, and that she's trying to kill kids or something. Like, was there something going on? And then, as things unravel to the point at the end, like, you find out that Lily died and teeth removed, you're like, oh crap, it's this girl, which is scary in itself, right? I mean, a 13-year-old girl murdering people and pulling out their teeth is terrifying, you know? So I think,
Strangling, because Alma
yeah.
was the one strangling I guess the girls held her down, and she was the one. It's, yeah, it's, which don't we find out that like strangling and knifing are like crimes of passion because of how close you have to get to somebody? So that's just nuts. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's just, I think it was really, really done well for as violent as it was, you know? Because there is a lot of violence in the book, because we have animal slaughter, the hogs, right? Sexual assault, we have cutting, we have biting, we have this murder. How are the characters respond, like the characters in various ways are responding to it? And what did you think of the way the town seemed to respond to it? You know, like what were they doing to cope with the fact that this violence was happening in their town? Were they like burying their heads in the sand? Were they confronting it? Like, what was your take?
Yeah, I would say that they were burying their heads in the sand to a certain extent and always thinking that it was outside, right? Which I think I can't recall if this was John or somebody else making this point, but, or maybe it was about John, because that was, you know, some people thought that we're going to look for an outside problem because you never want to think that the, you know, the tumor is in, or the cancer is in your own town. And so it seemed like everyone was doing what they normally do, with the exception of the families that lost their child. But even, you know, the interviews that Camille was doing with the first victim, whose name I have forgotten, Anne. Okay, it was Anne. I was like, was
Anne
it
was the first victim,
Anne?
Natalie was the second one.
Yeah. That house was chaotic, you know, because they had all those other children, so it seemed like you had to kind of move on quickly. And the way the father talked, like, yeah, it was just odd. Natalie's house, I think, maybe seemed the most, as we would imagine it, normal to something like this happening. And then everyone else maybe just doesn't want to necessarily talk about it, which you can see from Adora. How do people react to the actual violence and things? It seems like, I think that this town, it's like clear, it almost reminds me of Derry. I don't know, because, you know, these things happen and it goes through this cycle, because it seems like this town is just all about the violence, whether it's sexual or physical violence. But people are either blissfully unaware or they do know and they hold it against the person, and then, you know, the person comes back or stays there, or the, you know, because the town is all about the gossip as well.
Yeah.
So I think they're fully aware of what the cancer is in the town, but they don't do anything about it.
Yeah, they certainly would gossip with one another, but when it's reported to the outside world, they get offended.
Yeah.
You know, like they're talking about the same things that appear in the newspaper, but it's horribly offensive that it's appearing on the news. You know, and those are insular communities, right? You know, so that makes total sense. And that was another way I thought she did really well. All right. So I got a couple more questions. The second one will be the required reading question. So let the second to last question. So here's the paragraph from the biographical information I read toward the beginning of the episode. Flynn's portrayal of complex, morally ambiguous, and often unflattering female characters has drawn criticism from some critics who've accused her of misogyny. However, Flynn identifies as a feminist, and she defended her choice to write female characters who defy conventional expectations of women as inherently nurturing or morally virtuous. She states, quote, "The one thing that really frustrates me is this idea that women are innately good or innately nurturing. To her, people will dismiss trampy and vampy and bitchy types, but there's still a big pushback against the idea that women can be just pragmatically bad, evil, and selfish." So in the context of this book, what do you think? And is the misogyny criticism correct or right in some way or another? Like, what do you think of the criticism laid against her writing?
Yeah, it reminds me, I read a book, I guess it was last year, about the unlikable female characters, and how, I don't know, they like throw these labels on them, like bitch and whore and all that. And, you know, what does that look like? Why can't there be someone, you know, maybe that's their intention is to act this way, et cetera. A big example was Walt. What is his last name from Breaking Bad? Skyler, that people like hated for like,
oh, like, that character.
Yeah. Like just, but anyways, I don't think so. I think people are uncomfortable with this. If this were to be all men in this thing, everyone, it would be like, yeah, this kind of stuff happens because men are violent and men do violent and sexual thing. I hashtag not all men, but you know, this is it, typically, like if we were to look at statistics, typically men are, you know, at the helm of violent crimes and things like that. But I think people are uncomfortable when they are reading something that flips that. For example, probably a book that I should make you read for this show is called The Power by Naomi Alderman, who was kind of someone who studied under Handmaid's Tale author
Margaret Atwood.
Thank you. Yes. And the things that go on, women are doing these things, and it's like really uncomfortable to read this because we are unused to that sort of thing. So I don't think so. I think it's just like it's just taking a theme but having someone else do it, and of course people are going to be uncomfortable. She has in that quote, of course, she's dancing upon a topic that, and the theme that you and I talk about constantly because of our ties with classicism, that there it is really just this two sides that women are often given, right? Because when you say the nice person, I think Penelope. When you think of, you know, then I'm like, oh, well, Circe or Calypso or something like that. You also have, you know, in terms of like Victorian or, you know, 19th century, you've got like the crazy woman or the, I'm trying to think of what the other person is called. Oh, is it the Mary or the Madonna? Is that how they described it? Where, you know, like Jane Eyre versus Bertha, that sort of thing.
Yeah,
So we've always had this black and white dichotomy. And I think she's investigating here the gray, which I would consider Camille being gray. I would maybe put Adora in the gray too, if only because like, I think just things are like miswired there. And then, yeah, you've got some like really dark black with
Mama.
with Alma. Yeah. I think that the conversation, when we get down to me, because there is a meta conversation about misogyny, as if Flynn knew this was coming. When Richard and Camille are in, I think it's like a derelict cabin of some sort. She was showing him around like different sites and he already knew. And then I think there's a finger bang there. if just to give you a sense of what's going on. But she was talking about like different things that happened there. And she shares this story about this young girl, 13 years old, you know, being passed around by football players. I think maybe drinking was definitely involved. I cannot recall if she was drunk or not. And Richard is like, that was assault. That was rape. Like, that's really terrible. And then Camille goes off on this kind of tirade about like, that's what, you know, you feminists are like, you know, maybe it was her choice or whatever, which was a really, it made that whole discussion maybe uncomfortable of like, and I was trying to read like, what's going on here? Where's Camille coming from? What is the author trying to say here? If it were any other circumstance, maybe, because how she presents it later is like, it actually was her choice, but she's also a 13-year-old child. Mm-hmm. And I think that just like completely, changes things, which is why I said, like, I think her ideas of sex and love are really messed up. And so like, there are maybe seeds of that, but we don't know that Flynn was necessarily trying to make a commentary there, or she's just like, that is just how Camille is. But I feel like it would be a stretch to say that she hates women. I would have to reread, because this is one, right? You can't, I think, take one person's novel and necessarily say that. I would have to reread Gone Girl, which I can like remember the main story points, and then also reread Dark Places in order to, because I think you have to look fully at it. But from this, I mean, sure, if I looked at that conversation, I'd be really concerned. But if I look at everything and I look at Camille's character and I think, well, that's kind of in line with Camille and her character. And then, yeah, this discussion, like classicist ideas. And also, I think it's just coming from a deep seated, who wrote that quote? Was it a man or a woman? Or who was like critiquing?
Oh, I guess it's more just in the person. Wikipedia thing, so I'd have to look up what the... Yeah, I just wondered
typically who is, because I think if people are uncomfortable with it, it's because this is against the norm. And so that's kind of my main thinking.
Yeah, let me look it up and see what I can find the source for. You know, I think you've added a lot of nuance to a discussion that's on the internet that does not necessarily get the nuance that it needs, right? Our culture is very, very quick to just criticize through slapping labels and condemning, rather than looking at the kind of kind of looking at the complexity of the thing and how a character like that can be very complex and everything. And I think it kind of cheapens the discussion when you just like flat out say, well, guess what? I'm going to be, you know, no, you're just misogyny. The source that's used is a May 2013 interview with The Guardian. It says Gillian Flynn on her bestseller Gone Girl and accusations of misogyny. So, so I don't know like who has said it or what.
Who the author was.
Yeah, who the author was. So the author was Oliver Berkman, but that he was the one conducting the interview.
Oh. Okay.
So I don't know if it's just been a general thing or
no. So if this were, I mean, obviously the murders and are very disturbing all on their own, but if this were a teenage boy, do you think you would have been as affected?
You know, no, because we've seen the teenage boy story before,
right?
Or the young man, right? I mean, and so I think you're right. I think it's the fact that this. And she's not an Amma is not an anti-hero or anything like that. So you can get some sympathy for her because of the way she's being raised. But at the same time, this is not a justifiable homicide. She's not taking care of people who are mean to her. She's just really, really is behaving in a very, very evil way. So I tend to believe you there and agree with you without really having to add very much. So but yeah, no, I don't see anything about like, who specifically has
Okay.
called, her a misogynist. So no, I tend to disagree with the idea that this is a misogynist, that this is a misogynist portrayal. And I think Gone Girl's the same way. I think you have a complex character and she's the character in that novel is twisted.
Yeah.
And part of it is because of the way her parents brought her up too. I mean, we're not discussing the novel right now, but like, but so there's definitely a nurture aspect to it or a lack of nurture aspect to it. But, go there with those characters, right? You can't, you can't, I think she's right. You can't always have the same two type of characters for women. You need the cruelty sometimes. It certainly made for an interesting narrative, and I agree with you on how Camille is just this very gray character, and that's what makes her compelling.
Yeah.
So, all right. So before I head into feedback, Stella, is this required reading?
Oof. I'm going to say no, if only because I can't think of a context that I think it would serve. And I think thematically, mother-daughter relationships and self-harm and things, I might be able to explore that with maybe a safer is not going to be the word, but some novel that might not be as intense. I think that this is, thinking like teaching, I could teach it at a collegiate level, with many trigger warnings, but in no way could I think pulling this in here unless doing character studies, which would be really interesting. But I just think it's like so psychologically intense that I don't even recommend it to any like an adult reader unless you feel like you can do some of these topics.
I would recommend it in the algorithmic way of if you liked Gone Girl or Dark
Oh,
Places, then
sure.
you should read this because then
Yeah.
you've already gone down one rabbit hole with Gillian Flynn. Try the others. Or if you ha did enjoy the TV series but never read the book, I would go read the book. It's, because it's a very good book. It's not something I would say outright that you need to read, So we've over the years of doing this podcast almost developed this kind of scale or spectrum of required reading, and it seems like so it's not a dichotomy, it's not black and white. This it's a very gray book, and so like
Yeah.
if you're into this sort of story and you have read Gillian Flynn's other work and you haven't read this, I would go read this. If it's not what this might not be your cup of tea as far as like what you like to read, and be aware that there is some seriously horrific content, and that can be hard to get through and hard to react to. So yeah. All right. We do have a few a couple of comments that I strung together that Robert Ward wrote on The Great Gatsby. He did point out that he's in Chicago, and he is the musical version of The Great Gatsby is making its way soon. He seems pretty excited.
Yep.
Have you ever seen that?
I have not. There, Jeremy Jordan and Eva Nobilizada were the originals. It didn't look like super. I listened to like some of the music and I thought, oh, it's okay. But I have not seen it.
Okay. So then he gives us his history of The Great Gatsby. He says, I was in Chicago with friends for a music festival. It was my birthday, and we went out to eat afterwards. It was decided to put this on while it was on Netflix. Everyone fell asleep, but I was enthralled and stay awake watching it. I have since listened to two audiobooks of the novel, one read by Jake Gyllenhaal. I also have a shirt of the novel cover. I haven't seen the Robert Redford version yet, but really want to. Maybe I'll rent it online this weekend. All of this was just last year, by the way. And then we had mentioned that Percy Jackson, which came out the day we recorded this, so we don't have any real feedback for that yet. Regarding our previewing of Percy Jackson, he said, I mentioned this on Stella's Goodreads status, but I had a coworker that recommended the Percy Jackson books to me. She was a big fan of the follow-up series, Heroes of Olympus. I read the original books, Heroes, and currently reading the newest Percy books that are being published. I think that the earliest Percy books could be a little rough. I have enjoyed the series and really been really enjoying the latest ones. The Persebeth romance, so that's Annabeth and Percy, or Percy and Annabeth, can be really fun, and I absolutely love the interactions between the two. When they were reunited in Heroes, hilarious. I would definitely recommend Stella to read The Sun and the Star, co-written by Mark Oshiro, if she has read all of the Percy Universe books, but not that one. So there's your shipping, Stella.
Yeah, I've not read any Percy except for what we had done.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something I talked about in our episode, which is, I guess, shocking in regards to the shipping. But I did tell Robert somewhere else mm-hmm. that I didn't see any shipping from the book that we read.
Mm-hmm.
To be honest, it was I feel like maybe they just became friends at the end because it was just so much of a rivalry. But people are telling me that they do, I guess, get romantically involved. So that's one of yeah. those things, like, you'd have to convince me that they actually do belong together, because I did not see it in that first book.
I could see it based okay. on the first book, based on kind of like some of their interactions, but it's like really nascent, like subtle below the surface, and not like you could take it in either direction at that point. But like, if you were to get the two of them together, I could see, like, back to the origin point of like, okay, this would have happened, but it's so early in the first book that you could just have them always be friends and it would be fine, you know. It wouldn't ruin anything as far as like, oh, I thought we were going to ship them. I don't remember what it's like in the second book, because I read the second book a long time ago and I never read the others, so I might. Brett still has them. So, all right. So that's it. Go ahead and send us your feedback and everything. Before we go, Stella, you have the next pick. You have the October pick.
Finally. Yeah, it's been so long. Tom always takes the holidays because he says, I'm a cis white man, and that means I deserve everything.
Oh, yes. So that's exactly what I tell you every time we do this. Yes.
He's, you know, one of those entitled people. So, yeah, I really want to read Salem's Lot, but I think now is not the time, if only because I feel like we just did a vampire book and we've done several Stephen King.
The King novel, yeah.
So I just wanted to go through my thought process. And then I was thinking, you know what we've not done for a while is a comic of sort. And then I was thinking, well, there is a seminal Halloween like comic that we could do. Unfortunately, it is starring Batshirk, so we're just gonna have to get over that, but it is a good one. So we're gonna do The Long Halloween, Batman The Long Halloween by Jeff Loeb and Tim Sale.
All right, well, come back for that. We haven't done a graphic novel in a long while, so I'm looking forward to that. And we've only ever done one superhero graphic novel. It was that X-Men, God Loves, Man Kills, and that was a long time ago. So this will be pretty cool to see. And if you know Stella and I, we both have strong opinions on the Batjerk, because we both are fans of their sidekicks.
Yes.
And associates and their family, who Batman doesn't seem to ever want to actually, you know, nurture. Yeah. So anyway, come back for that next month. And until then, as always, thank you very much for listening and take care.
Yeah. And I hope that out there somewhere, John is doing okay.
Maybe he's tickling the ivories.
That's terrible. You're a terrible human being. I was trying to think. I was like, I don't remember him being a piano player. You're a sick man.
Right?
Jeez. Thanks
Thanks for listening to Required Reading with Tom and Stella, which is brought to you by Two True Freaks. That's Two True Freaks. If you're interested in learning more about the books we've read or want to comment on the episode, follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/requiredreadingwithtomandstella.
If you would like to email us to comment on the episode or continue our discussion, you can reach us at requiredreadingcast@gmail.com. We will read every email we get on future episodes.
We're looking for more visibility, so if you liked this episode or the show in general, why not leave us a review in iTunes? Thanks again for listening, and come back next month for our next episode.